This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, my producer Lee Delapina. We are in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, and we do want to welcome everybody joining us on our brand new Sirius XM channel, Sirius 220 and XM channel 206, and of course to everybody streaming us around the world on our website, horseracingradio.net. We welcome you to Trainer Talk here, and really looking forward to this edition. I tell you at the beginning of every show how fortunate I am to be able to talk with so many of the people that make this sport a success. And you know I'm talking about the trainers, the people who dedicate their entire lives to this sport, and we get to reap the benefits as fans and as media members. And really it all starts with the trainers, and couldn't be happier with tonight's guest. It is 66-year-old English native, a man who was inducted into racing's Hall of Fame in 2000. To date, this person has saddled 1,383 winners in that Hall of Fame career. His runners have earned, are you ready for this, more than $94 million in purses. Among those winners, a multitude of champions, including 1993 Belmont Stakes winner AP Indy. He has conditioned the winners of six Breeders' Cup races, and in 2000 took home the Roses by winning the Kentucky Derby with Fusaichi Pegasus. He is trainer Neil Drysdale, and he is nice enough to be with me tonight on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Neil, thanks so much for taking the time.
It's a pleasure, Mike.
Yeah, happy to have you on board with me. And Neil, let's just cut to the chase. $94 million in purses. Where's all the money?
I don't know. I'm broke again. Why I'm working my ass off still.
Pretty remarkable. You know, at this point in your career, when you hear people walk through your lengthy list of accolades, what goes through your mind?
Well, I think in this business, you're more concerned about tomorrow than you are about what happened yesterday. So you know, you're always looking towards the future in this business. You're always looking for the next two-year-old, the next three-year-old, the next champion grass horse. I think that's the way it works, you know?
Yeah, and it's a game that's built on dreams. We say that here on the network.
Yeah, I see you're always worrying about it. You're always thinking and dreaming about tomorrow. I'm not sure there's too much looking back.
Well, I can tell you, your success is quite remarkable, considering that growing up, you had other interests and even spent some time teaching before deciding to become involved with horses.
Oh, that was when I was a struggling student. That was to make ends meet. That was not a vocation.
Take me back to those early years,
Neil.
That was
to be able to eat.
That was just trying to survive at that point.
Yeah, it's at university. So you need to make ends meet. And so I used to exercise horses in the morning. And then jumpers.
Okay.
And teach English and do whatever I could, just like many other people do today.
So you always, from a very young age, had an interest in horses?
I grew up with horses. So my father liked to hunt foxes and things like that. So now I grew up in show jumping, and then I switched over to thoroughbreds when I was in Florida. Went to work for John Hardigan at Tartan Farms. John Narrod and John Hardigan.
Was your dad in any way involved with racing at all, or was it just the fox?
No, he was an amateur. He liked to hunt, steeple chasing, pointer pointing, and stuff like that.
Did he ever encourage you to get involved with thoroughbreds at all?
Good Lord, no. No. He actually was a famous soldier.
So are you the only member of your family that's involved with racing?
Yes. Other than, well, my nephew, he owns horses, which is the right way to do it. He wanted to go into racing, and I told him, you should get another form of income and then own them. So that he owns steeplechasing.
So what was the reaction of from your parents and your family members when you told them, hey, look, I'm moving to the United States. I want to get involved with horses on a different level?
Oh, no, actually, what I did is I came over to the United States with show jumping.
Okay.
And then I switched. And I switched into thoroughbreds. I was already in Florida, and I switched over to thoroughbreds and went to work at Totten Farms in Ocala.
Sure. Yeah. Did they like the idea of you leaving home to go to the States?
Well, it's a different setup in England. You leave home when you're quite young, and so my father had already been stationed in Quantico after the Korean War. So I spent a couple of years in kindergarten there.
Okay.
Now that's we were always sent away to school in England. So you leave home quite young.
It's a pretty big move to make that jump. But was it, well, I guess at that age, it probably wasn't very nerve-wracking because you were so young, right?
Well, no, I'd already been away in the University of Barcelona in Spain. And you're taught a lot of independence when you grow up. In that system.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I think back on those early days of Neil Drysdale, the one word that always comes to mind is globetrotter. And you definitely got to see the world, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Then I went to work in South America for a couple of years. And then I came back and just trying to think who I went to work for first. I think I went to work for Roger Lauren.
Okay.
And then but I had Roger Lauren's horses in Lucien's barn, in Lucien Lauren's barn. So it was good. It was a good time. Good horses.
When you were growing up...
You might know some of them, you know?
There were some pretty good horses in that barn, for sure.
Yes, I started off with... It was Drum Top, an hydrologist, and then I was in Lucien's barn, so there's a horse called River Ridge, and then there was another one came off the scene called Secretariat. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they were okay.
Mm-hmm.
They could run a little.
And then after that, I went to work for Whittingham, and I spent 4 or 5 years with Whittingham as his assistant.
So I'm going to go out on a limb, Neil, and say that you probably took a little bit from each person that you're still incorporating today. Is that right?
I think you do. I think, horse is a horse. But obviously, the people you work with, Whittingham had a huge influence on me. And then he was a very kind, gracious man to me. He sent me off to one summer. He sent me to Vincent O'Brien's. Another summer, he sent me to Dolville with Jack Cunnington.
Mm-hmm.
So. And then I used to go around to South America for him, buying South American horses, because I'd been down there for a couple of years, so I knew my way about. But you definitely, obviously, absorb to wherever you are. A trainer's job is to notice things and watch things and absorb stuff, as I just said, feeding myself. But you can't help but learn from people. You learn every day. Even now, to this day, you keep learning. One keeps. It's a game of interesting developments that never stop and never cease to amaze one.
It amazes me to hear you tell me that you never stop learning, because with everything you've accomplished, you would think that by now you'd be doing all the teaching, but you're still trying to learn.
Well, yeah, obviously, because it's a changing. It's a changing environment, and the game changes, and if you don't change with it, you sort of get a bit left behind.
How much has the game changed, and what are the biggest changes you've seen since you became involved?
Well, I think the first thing, when I first joined Whittingham, for example, there wasn't a lot of money involved. And so you did it because you really enjoyed it. And then in the 80s, suddenly there was a huge amount of money involved. And, you know, the Mac Tooms came into the sport and the cost of yearlings went sky high and the prices started to creep up. I think that's probably the biggest change I've seen, that there's a lot of money involved. And I think now I think my impression is the pendulum's swinging a bit the other way now.
Has that meant that you've had to adjust the way that you run your operation as well, Neil?
Yeah, you know, we're adjusting all the time, you know, because now we're in the age of information. So we've gone past the keeping owners in, like, treat. I think Whittingham used to have an expression, treat owners like mushrooms, keep them in the dark and feed them bullshit.
Right.
So that's long, long gone. Now we're in the age of information age and some transparency. So you have to adapt with the times.
As you were growing up, Neil, was there a trainer that you looked up to or you followed?
At what period? In what period?
I guess.
I mean, there's some fantastic trainers around. I mean, there's some absolutely amazing people. I think you know, Michael Stout, for example, in England. Henry Sessom just died. It's just amazing people. Dick Kern was a brilliant trainer in England. And, of course, Dr. O'Brien goes without saying. And I think now that this younger O'Brien, Aidan O'Brien, who's no relation, I think he's an outstanding trainer. And then within the United States, you have the same thing.
You know, I can imagine that growing up as a young man in England and watching so many of those top trainers that you just mentioned, that when you finally got the opportunity to run your horses against them and to compete in a race with them, I can imagine that was quite an experience for you, wasn't it?
No, because I never did it, because I always stayed in the United States.
Okay,
the
Breeders' Cup.
The ones we were just talking about were all English trainers.
Yeah, even in the Breeders' Cup.
Irish and English, both.
Okay. I would have thought maybe in one of those six Breeders' Cup victories.
I think what you're talking about more is this. What was it fun to be running against Whittingham when I started growing out on my own, when I went out on my own? Yeah, it was fun when I beat him, but it wasn't so much fun when I finished up the track. Because as he would say, well, I taught him everything he knows, but not all that I know.
What did Charlie teach you? What are some of the most important lessons you learned in working with Charlie?
Oh, I think, you know, the primary one is to be patient. You know, that was probably the most important. And that and how to plan campaigns so that you get to where you want to go to.
Talking with trainer Neil Drysdale on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Neil, what year did you finally make the decision to go out on your own?
That decision actually wasn't mine. It was made by Whittingham.
Really?
By Whittingham, you know, because I was offered various jobs, and he said, you know, I wasn't ready. And then finally one day he said, yeah, you're ready.
You're kidding me. It was that simple?
It was that simple.
Did you feel like you were ready at that time?
I had a pretty good draft for it, and this job came up. I initially was going to go and train in Europe, and then this job came up. I mean, I had the horses nominated to the races in Europe, and I was going to train in France. And then when this job came up, a private job with a fellow from Houston, an old man from Houston called Corbin Robertson. And he had a stable called Saron, S-A-R-O-N, Saron Stable.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously the easiest way to start training horses as a private job, because you have a salary, you don't have to put up any money, and the horses are there. So that was good, and we started off well and had a very good first year, and then I was there for about 9 years with him working with Mr. Robertson. So then after that, I opened a public stable. I think, if I remember, that my dates are a little bit hazy. So I think in 74, I think, or 75, I started training.
When you
and then 9 years later, I opened up a public stable.
Yeah, when you open that public stable, do you think that being a private trainer, having been established a little bit in that direction, was able to help you when you went out on your own?
Yes, definitely. Because people had come up to me and said, you know, if you ever open up a public stable, then you know, we'd be interested in having a horse with you over the years. And so I just, fortunately, at that time, I had a good memory. So when I did open up a public stable, in those days, we used to use telephones. So I just started ringing up everybody and said, I'm going to open up a public stable.
What was the best advice that you've ever received when you started training?
The best advice probably was, I was told, never to screw with your staff or your owners, because otherwise they'll end up screwing you. It actually wasn't said like that. It was used with an F word.
What advice would you give to a new trainer just getting started today?
No, that's a difficult one. That's a very difficult one.
How come?
Well, because I think, you know, we're going through a little bit of change. And I think probably you just got to go wherever you're able to train good horses. I think it's a very important key. So if you have to go off to start off your career in wherever it might be in Dubai or wherever, you know, there's racing all around the world now. But I think you have to go where you're going to have access to good horses.
You know, it's interesting because you mentioned traveling all over the world, Neil, and experiencing racing and the industry in different parts of the world. Why did you ultimately decide to settle here in the United States? Because I'm sure you could have gone to other places.
Well, no, because I was offered this very good job by this Texas fellow, so that's why I stayed. Yeah, otherwise, I would have wound up in France. If I hadn't been offered the job, I would have been in France.
Okay.
Yeah. I was offered some other jobs, but that was a very palatable one.
So is it safe to say that that was your first big break, is getting that private job?
Probably my first break was going to work for John Hardigan.
Okay.
You know, that was my first introduction into thoroughbred racing, was with John Hardigan and John Nared at Tartan Farms.
Mm-hmm.
So that, because he was very instrumental in teaching me how to work and giving me a good work ethic.
Yeah, and I can imagine that must have given you a lot of confidence when you finally went to work for guys like Charlie, knowing that you had been there and working with those gentlemen in Florida. You had a good foundation by the time you got to Charlie.
Yes. Yeah, so when I'd already done 2 years. I did 2 years there and then a couple of years in South America, and then I came back and I'd already done over a year with Lauren. So when I came out to work for Whittingham, I mean, I've already been knocking around for half a dozen years, you know?
You know, everybody seems to have a favorite Charlie Whittingham story when I interview them here on this program. Does Neil Drysdale have a favorite Whittingham story?
Too many to talk about, and the ones I would like to tell, I'm not allowed to.
He was quite a character from everything I understand.
He was. He was a very special man. Yeah. Very, very special, man.
Neil Drysdale here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Neil, you leave the private job. You go out on your own as a public stable. And let's focus on the 1980s for a minute here, because the first 10 to 12 years of your career, you're doing pretty well. Things are going along well. Then things really start to pick up in the early to mid 1980s. You win your first Breeders' Cup race with Princess Rooney in the 84 Distaff. The next year, you win the Breeders' Cup Juvenile with Tasso.
Well, yeah, that ties in with when I went public.
Okay.
So in other words, I went public in whatever year, 83, 84, I can't remember, but 84. And what happened is they let out one group of horses, and then they let in the other horses. And, of course, there was Princess Rooney was in that group, and there were some very good horses they let into the stable. So we just, when I switched to public, they let out, they let in some very good horses.
Yeah, but that's quite the way to
so,
kick
so
off.
I started off with a bang. As a public trainer, I started off with a bang. I think we had Princess Rooney was my first year as a public trainer.
Yeah, that's quite the way to kick off your career as a public trainer. You get a horse like Princess Rooney, who was so sensational. What do you remember most about Princess Rooney?
We were trying to decide whether to run her against the Colts in the Classic or to stay against the fillies. And she'd just missed being a two-year-old champion, missed being a three-year-old champion. So we sat down the night before and said, well, where are we going to go with her? Because I felt she just peaked at the right time, and I felt that she could have beaten the boys. And we opted to go the conservative route and run her in the distaff against the fillies to cement the fact that she'd be champion, so she'd retire as being a champion. And it worked out well. But at the same time, she ran a second faster than the boys, and she was breezing. He never took a stick out. So she could have won the Classic.
Do you regret that decision?
That's all hindsight.
After that, do you regret that decision?
No. No, I think a lot of times in this business, every now and again you need to take a punt, but most of the times it pays off to be fairly conservative.
Yeah, very much so. We see that a lot in the game, and people get a little too ambitious, and it doesn't always work out, but certainly Princess Rooney proved herself a champion that day in 1984. The next year you come back in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile with Tasso, and I know that was a very special moment for you as well.
Well, Tasso is an interesting thing. We decided to go ahead and supplement him to the Breeders' Cup because we felt that if he won the Breeders' Cup, he'd be champion two-year-olds. And of course, he got up to beat Stormcap by a nose or a head or something. So that worked out because after that, the horse was syndicated. So and then he didn't turn out to be much of a two-year-old or a three-year-old. So that worked out well.
Yeah, and you mentioned the word champion a couple of times when talking about the goal with Princess Rooney and the goal with Tasso. Those are things that trainers really do think about when they're planning out campaigns, don't they?
Oh yeah, no. You have to, if you think you got one good enough, then you need to sit back and figure out how to get to. Well, we mentioned that right at the beginning of the program. Sit down and figure out how to get to where you want to go.
Well, then comes 1989, and for whatever reason, things go to a whole new level for you in 89. You win 69 races, which at the time was a record for you. You eclipse $5.5 million in purses. What made 1989 so special?
1989, I don't really remember the years that well, but if I won that much, it was probably the year that we decided we went up and had a lot of horses, and at the end of it, we decided it was a mistake. That we won a lot of purse money, but financially it didn't work, and I was very exhausted. And so then we cut back to 40 horses, and that's where we stayed ever since.
Yeah, that was the year with Prized winning the Breeders' Cup Turf, and you were second in the Distaff with Gorgeous, and then Sabona second in the Breeders' Cup Miles. So that was a pretty darn good year for you.
Yeah, that was a good year, but we had a lot of horses that year, and then after that we decided to cut it back to 40.
So I guess when we see trainers that do train a lot of horses, it is possible for somebody to say, hey, wait a minute, that's just too many. I don't want to be involved with that many. I'd like to have a smaller stable.
Sorry, I couldn't hear you. The wind cut you off. The breeze come up.
You talk about cutting back in numbers, and that's something that I think a lot of people don't realize with trainers is that some trainers would much rather have a smaller stable than have to worry about 100, 130, 140 horses.
Yeah, I mean, we did it, you know, we did it on purpose. I mean, we sorted it out, and I'm just much more comfortable with a small group of horses. I mean, I know today, in today's world, everybody's got, the top trainers have 100 here or 200 or 150 or whatever it is. I'm just more comfortable with a smaller group. I just really enjoy training the horses as opposed to managing. Everybody's different. You know, different strokes are different folks. So I'm just more comfortable with a smaller group of horses. The only drawback with a smaller group of horses is that sometimes you'll have a weak year, and then you'll have a good year. You're not going to have a constant top of the line year. With that limited amount of horses, sometimes you don't have that. They're not good. You know, you wind up with a stable that's a bit weak. That's the only drawback.
Neil, was there a point, considering all the success you had in the 80s, was there a point when you could finally take a deep breath and say, okay, I've made it?
Well, I don't think you ever think that in this business. I think you're only as good as your next winner. I mean, you know, I know it's an old saying, but there's a lot of truth to it. You know, people are not too much worried about what you did for them. They're more worried about what you are going to do for them. You know, it's a funny old business, but it's bloody good fun.
Enjoying my visit with Neil Drysdale here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Still to come, we'll talk about AP Indy. We'll talk about going to the Kentucky Derby with Fusaichi Pegasus. And we'll talk about that day when Neil Drysdale was inducted into racing's Hall of Fame. It's coming up in the second half of the program. Stay with me here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. The Fasig Tipton November sale is the market leader. The 2013 November sale had the highest average of any mixed sale in the world, with 24 horses selling for $1 million and higher, more than any other breeding stock sale in the world. And the 2013 November sale provided an outstanding weanling market with a $500,000 foal and a $100,000 plus average, while also producing the highest priced horse sold in North America last year, when Better, Better, Better went under the gavel at $5.2 million. The Fasig Tipton November sale, Monday, November 3rd in Lexington, Kentucky. The market leader. Breathing easy is the key to equine performance and health. That's why horsemen around the world count on Flair nasal strips to protect the lungs of their equine athletes without drugs. Flair strips' gentle support of the nasal passages reduces the soft tissue collapse that occurs in all horses during intensive exercise. 7 clinical studies prove the benefits of Flair strips for reducing lung bleeding, reducing fatigue, and shortening recovery time. Reduce bleeding, recover faster, perform better. Prevent, protect, perform with Flair strips.
For racing coverage from the inside out.
I still kicked away and I thought I really had it until the 16th pole. Amazing little horse.
International English events.
A clear round and under the time limit will get you into the jump off.
And hard-fought Western competition.
Here we go, guys, let's help him. You bet. Woo!
Tune in to HRTV, the network for horse sports. Online at hrtv.com.
This is the EPO Equine Stimulating Performance of the Day.
And here come the Lewis Dinner and Shoot the Moon. Both of those two gaining ground on the outside. It's Kizan with the lead. The Lewis Dinner moves into second. On the inside is Go Babe. And then it's a Shoot the Moon and Rudy Rendezvous. Half mile in 46-1. It's Kizan holding off the Lewis Dinner. Kizan in front by 2.5 lengths. Now by 3. The Lewis Dinner in second. And farther back, Go Babe, Rudy Rendezvous, and Shoot the Moon. And it's going to be Kizan who upsets the odds-on favorite here. Kizan won by almost 6 lengths. The Lewis Dinner was second. Then Go Babe and Rudy Rendezvous was fourth. Big long shot.
And that is your EPO Equine Stimulating Performance of the Day, brought to you by EPO Equine, the all-natural EPO stimulator for your horses, and Unlock. Keep your horse from tying up with Unlock and unlock the power. Now, if you want to learn more about either product, give my man Joey Diamond a call. His name is actually Joe Valente, but there's a whole story behind Joey Diamond that I'm just not getting into right now. Now, here's the deal. You give Joey Diamond a call at 215-501-6880, and he will help you and tell you all about these great products and how you can help your horse. You don't have to buy anything. You just give Joey a call and let him tell you about helping your horses. There's a reason the top operations like Webb Carroll and Hartley Dorenzo and Scott Lake, Steve Margolis, Roger Brueggemann of Midwest Thoroughbreds, John Service, Ramon Preciado, there's a reason that all of those operations are using these products and they're seeing the benefits of EPO Equine and Unlock. So give Joey Diamond a call today and you can learn about helping your horses right now. 215-501-6880. That's 215-501-6880. You can always go to epoequine.com. Order from there, but give Joey a call. You don't have to buy anything. He just wants to tell you about the product, and I promise you, you won't be disappointed. 215-501-6880.
This is Christophe Clément. You are listening to the Horse Racing Video Network.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live, presented by Basic Tipton.
Welcome back to the second half of Trainer Talk here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Of course, all presented by our friends at Phasic Tipton. Don't forget, you're listening on our brand new SiriusXM channels. You can catch this show every Wednesday evening on Sirius 220 XM channel 206. And as always, all of our shows are broadcast, all streaming live at horseracingradio.net. And yes, podcast there as well, and available on iTunes. So no excuse. You can listen to the Horse Racing Radio Network anywhere, anyhow that you would like. And you can do that through our website, horseracingradio.net. Mike Penna in studio with my producer, Lee Delapina. Really fun visit with Hall of Fame trainer Neil Drysdale in the first half of the program. And we're really just getting started. We touched on so much of Neil's success in the early days, walking through the 1980s. And then comes a little horse by the name of AP Indy, who provides Neil with his very first win in a classic race, the 1992 Belmont. And Neil, this is a game, we say it all the time, it has the highest highs and the lowest lows, and you experienced the full gamut of emotions with AP Indy in a five-week time period, beginning just hours before what would be your very first Kentucky Derby.
Well, not really. He actually developed a foot problem the night before the race. So unfortunately, his owner had flown all the way from Japan, and so we did actually work on the foot all night. And then in the morning, he warmed up out of it, but I could see he still wasn't quite right. So we went ahead and scratched him, and then discovered what the problem was. He had a blind quarter crack. And then we sorted that out and ran him in the Peter Pan, which he won well, and then he came back to the Belmont. And Delahousie afterwards said he had quite a lot of horse left in the Belmont that he was quite winning the race quite comfortably.
And yeah, I can't even imagine what it's like to get that phone call or to even go to the barn and see that there is something amiss with AP Indy right before the big race, so to speak, right before you finally get to the Kentucky Derby. That had to be gut-wrenching.
You just do, it's your job, so you do what's correct. I mean, that's the main thing, not to let your emotions get in the way. You just do what you've got to do.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Neil, but that's not that wasn't the first time that you had those Derby hopes derailed, because when Tasso, who we talked about in the first half of the show, was a three-year-old, didn't he have some issues? Was it right before the Wood Memorial?
Yes. Yeah, he did. Yeah, he had the same thing. He had a different deal where he was walking on the track at Aqueduct and they dropped some steel pipes. So, he was feeling well. He went up in the air and came down and grabbed his quarter badly.
Jeez.
And then we were fussing with that most, we didn't heal well.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can only imagine what was going through your mind, especially after AP Indy. Does that make a trainer realize exactly how difficult it is to make it to the Derby and maybe even appreciate it more when you do get the chance?
Well, it's a difficult assignment. You have to have a very special horse. So I think everybody realizes how difficult it is. I don't think you need to be reminded.
Were you beginning to wonder if it would ever happen?
No, I think it's a matter of if you have the horse and you're just doing what's right by the horse. I know it sounds trite, but that's the truth of it,
And then to see him come back and win the Belmont Stakes the way he did, obviously you were elated, but maybe was there some part of you that said, geez, I wonder what might have been?
No, never look back. Never look back. At that point, then you're thinking about, well, how do I get to the Breeders' Cup?
Which turned out to be quite successful.
We had to let the foot grow out. His foot was a bit of a mess. So we had to let the foot grow out.
But was he a bit of a challenge for you to train, Neil, only because of those little issues that kept popping up?
Well, he was a strong, he was a big, strong horse. We did have a couple of problems, with his feet. One in the jockey club, he went down his knees and ripped the shoe off, and he ran the whole race with no shoe. So when we got back, the foot was gone. It was shredded by the sand. So there you go. We had to rebuild the foot. We did it that night. Spent all night doing it.
Wow. Wow, how remarkable is that?
And that was prior to the Breeders' Cup in Gulfstream, which he won very easily.
Well, fast forward 8 years from AP Indy, and you finally get the opportunity to compete in the Kentucky Derby in 2000 with Fusaichi Pegasus. Take me through your emotions from that day as you finally got to make the walkover, you finally got to saddle your horse in the Derby, and especially after all of those other close calls and so many other disappointments.
Well, there hadn't been that many disappointments. It's, in other words, we're very pleased with the way the horse came into the race. He trained well into the race. He was a difficult horse to train, but he was very talented and got the job done. On to the next. He was a very talented horse, and he deserved to win the race. He was quite extraordinary in different ways.
Well, and his performance in the Kentucky Derby was extraordinary as well. What do you remember about that day and being at Churchill Downs, Neil?
Well, we'd been there for some time. We came into the race. We didn't just ship in. We'd been trained. We trained over the track for some time. I was very pleased with the horse. He did his thing. I prefer to let the horses do the talking, and so I'm sort of wondering what you want, where you're going with this.
I can imagine.
I don't do touchy-feely things. I don't discuss touchy-feely matters.
Yeah, I can imagine it had to be very special. Regardless, it had to be a special day for you. And just curious too, Neil, if it makes you, after winning the Kentucky Derby, if it makes you want to get back there even more.
I'm sort of repeating myself here. If you've got the horse, then if you don't have the correct type of horse, then you're going to spend a lot of money and going to have a little bit of heartbreak. It takes a special type of horse So and that's, and every now and again, you can back into something like that. But normally, you need a superior horse that's coming into himself at the right time.
Well, that very much ties
If I had the horse, yeah, obviously I'd go back. But I'm not going to go back there just to be running in that race.
Yeah, that very much ties in to what you mentioned in your Hall of Fame induction speech, Neil, where you thanked so many of the people, your owners, the people that work with you, but you also thanked all of the horses that you had the privilege to be around throughout the years that helped you get to that point. And for you, it's always been the horse first and foremost.
It's the horse that, you know, obviously you have to have the owners that are willing to entrust you with their horses. And of course, you've got to have a really good staff. I mean, it doesn't work. You can't do it all on your own. You have to have a very good. I'm very fortunate. I've had an assistant that's been with me for many years, and he's very, very skilled in his own right. And he's been with me for many years, John O'Donoghue.
Neil Drysdale here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Neil, who made the phone call that you received telling you were going to be in the Hall of Fame?
I have no idea who rang me. I can't remember. I can't remember that. That's a long time ago. Let's talk about tomorrow.
All right, let's talk about what's ahead. I'll tell you what. Answer this question for me then, Neil. What still drives Neil Drysdale?
I think just being around good horses, it's a thrill to get up in the morning, go to work, and the better the horses are, the more exciting it is coming to work.
You know, I read somewhere that you never go out the night before a big race. Is that still the case today?
Yeah, that is. Wow, you've done some research.
I read that somewhere. I thought that was interesting.
It's true, yeah. So, main thing is that you need your wits about you the next day.
So, what has Neil Drysdale enjoyed most about training horses?
I suppose the development, you know, taking them from a young age and doing the right thing, not messing them up.
I can imagine that when you finally get a horse to the starting gate, especially if it was a horse that you had to put in a little extra time with, Neil, there's that sense of fulfillment and being a little bit more rewarding, isn't there?
Yeah, and when you get this sense of fulfillment and reward when it goes past that lollipop first, yeah, and especially if it's doing it very easily.
So when your career is finished, Neil, and I know there's still plenty left to go, but when it's finished, what are some of the things that you want people in the sport to remember when they think of Neil Drysdale?
Well, I don't think like that at all. I can't even answer that question. That's not how I think.
Yeah, it's obvious that you know, it's interesting.
I mean, for Christ's sake, you're going to try and bury me and put me in the ground. You want me to give me? I'm not fond of giving out my what I think my epitaph should be.
It's interesting because just talking with you here for the past 45 minutes or so, you really learn that Neil Drysdale is not the type of person that wants to look back on his career. He's the type of person that wants to look ahead and that, look, there's still plenty more left to go for Neil Drysdale.
That's correct. And plus, I got a small daughter, 7 years old, and she has to go to college. So there you go.
Okay, now, what if your daughter comes to you and says, Dad, I want to be a horse trainer. What are you going to tell her?
I'm going to tell her she can do whatever she wishes to do. It's her life. And she loves the horses. She just loves all animals. Doesn't matter what it is. So even a goldfish has to be buried. So you have to have a funeral for goldfishes. So, she just enjoys being around animals.
Does she hang out around the barn quite a bit with you?
Yeah, no, she enjoys being in the stables. We don't encourage it. It's whatever she wishes to do, you know. No discouragement, no encouragement, but she does enjoy riding. And she enjoys being around the stables.
How about Neil Drysdale? What do you like to do when you're not around racing? Are there other interests that you have?
I do it from time to time. You know, I like to socialize, etc. I read a lot. You know, it's the same. Nothing. I'm fairly private.
Well, I imagine with training horses, you don't get the opportunity to get away from the barn very much, do you?
No, it seems the only time you get away is when you're going off to the sales in Kentucky, or you're going away, you know, or you're going to an away match somewhere, or you're, you know, in New York or Chicago. In other words, I guess, isn't there some sort of saying about a change is as good as a rest?
Sure. Sure.
So, I mean, because, you know, that, I mean, that's, I just be in the sales, and that was a nice break.
Now, I know that you don't like to look back on your career and that you don't like to talk about things that have happened in the past, but I also know that you mentioned it's very rewarding when you get everything to go right with a training job that you've done and the time you've put into a young horse. If you look back, which of those training jobs that you've done are you most proud of, Neil?
You can't compare horses. It's impossible. I mean, I know that one of the leading questions people ask to different people is, well, which was the best horse that you ever rode, or which was the best horse you ever trained? And they're all, I've never been able to answer that question because they're all so different. They do different things. You know, I find it very, very difficult to compare horses. Very difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, when you go to the sales, you mentioned being in Kentucky for the horse sales. That's a whole other aspect of training horses that people don't often think about. When you're at the sales, what's your philosophy when you're selecting young horses?
Well, generally, you know, you're selecting horses for other people, and it's more what they want than what you want. So, for example, if you're looking at horses for breeders, and they might want a specific type, a specific family, or some specific stallions. And as a trainer, your job is just to make sure that the horse is athletic and looks to be, you know, have good conformation, as well as the pedigree. It depends on who you're buying for and what they want the horse for, because there are so many different angles in this sport. You know, some people are thinking in terms of classics, and other people are thinking in terms of selling, or, you know, pin hooking. Just many, many different types of involvement in this industry. So I think when you're as a trainer, when you go to the sales, you're trying to buy an athletic individual that will fit into not just the pocketbook of the owner, but also into their philosophy about the sport and how they are involved in it. You know, some people like to sell on, or they like to buy fillies that they can turn around and breed, or alternatively, I have couple of clients that never breed, and they have fillies, and they just put the fillies back in onto the market and sell them at auction, or sell them privately.
And that was trainer Neil Drysdale, the Hall of Famer, on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Unfortunately, he comes up about 10 or 11 minutes short with the battery life in that cell phone. He gave me the warning before he came on the show. He said it's going to be close. And you know what? That's why he's in the Hall of Fame. The guy is always right, and he was right in this situation as well. Neil Drysdale, the 66-year-old native of England. What an unbelievable visit here tonight. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Really great stories, and really, when you look back on his career and all of the things that he has been able to accomplish, from somebody who grew up in England, just, you know, kind of being around the sport, but never really in it, so to speak, but then he comes here to the United States, and he's involved not with thoroughbreds, but with other breeds. And he kind of falls into the thoroughbred thing. And all of a sudden, he's traveling all over the world. He's working for guys like Charlie Winningham and Lucien Lauren. And the next thing you know, he's on his way to the Hall of Fame. He's winning 6 Breeders' Cup races. And you could tell in that interview with Neil, that he is not the type of person that wants to sit there and brag on Neil Drysdale. He doesn't want to look back like that on his career. He wants to keep looking ahead. And I think that's a remarkable trait. And, you know, I think it's a trait that we see not just in great trainers, but great athletes in any sport. They don't typically tend to want to look back. They want to look ahead. What's the next challenge? What's the next thing on the horizon for Neil Drysdale? 66 years old, still going strong, and still adding to those 1,383 career victories that he has to date. Pretty impressive stuff from Neil Drysdale. Wish I could have talked to him a little bit more about some of the other champions that he's had in his care. We touched on a few of them. We actually got a chance to talk about AP Indy, got a chance to talk about Princess Rooney a little bit, and Tasso. But remiss that we didn't get the chance to talk to him about Hollywood Wildcat and about Fiji, two of his other champions that were so brilliant. And Hollywood Wildcat, let's start with her for a minute, because when you think back on her career, she was one of my favorites. The winner of the 1993 Breeders' Cup Distaff, she was voted the Eclipse Champion Filly of that year. And I thought it would be appropriate, since Neil couldn't be here to do it, I thought it would be appropriate if we took a look back on that Distaff performance in 1993 from Hollywood Wildcat.
The field moving into the far turn now, and Hollywood Wildcat makes a run at the lead. Hollywood Wildcat on the outside, Super Gem digs down, and now Passiana poised and making her move for the lead, and Sky Beauty coming into contention on the outside. Dispute behind a wall of horses is fifth as the field turns for home, and Passiana has a short lead, but Hollywood Wildcat is right there with her, and those two headlong into the final furlong together. McCarran all over his champion there, Passiana on the inside. Hollywood Wildcat is resolute. Hollywood Wildcat and Passiana striding to the line. Here's the finish, and it's Hollywood Wildcat. Eddie Delahousse dropped his whip, but it looks like he got the victory. Passiana was right there in another thriller on Breeders' Cup Day 1993.
Hollywood Wildcat. You know, that's the other thing that I wanted to ask Neil about, and unfortunately didn't get the opportunity to do so, but that relationship with Eddie Delahousse, fellow Hall of Famer, they had a lot of success together, not just Hollywood Wildcat, certainly AP Indy as well. And you think about that relationship and that dynamic and what made it work with Neil Drysdale and Eddie Delahousse. We'll have to get him back on up the road here and ask him about that. But Hollywood Wildcat, that win, that field that year in the Breeders' Cup Distaff was as loaded a field as you're going to see. And the Breeders' Cup Distaff is always jam-packed with quality. But look back at the horses that were finishing behind her. Passiana, Sky Beauty, Dispute. I mean, those are three really big names, especially Passiana and Sky Beauty. But Neil Drysdale conditioning Hollywood Wildcat to that Breeders' Cup win. And again, six Breeders' Cup wins to his credit in that Hall of Fame career. Pretty remarkable. The other champion that he conditioned was a mare named Fiji. And Fiji was a British bred mare. And she was voted the 1998 champion grass mare. And she wasn't a Breeders' Cup winner. She was ultra solid with Great Estates Company, though, in that year of 1998. You look back at her victories that year, and we see wins in the Grade 2 Santa Ana Handicap at Santa Anita in March of 98. She comes back and wins the Santa Barbara Handicap, a Grade 2, in April. And then the Grade 1 Gamely at Hollywood Park in June. She was third after that in the Grade 1 Ramona Handicap at Del Mar, and then comes back and wins the Grade 1 Yellow Ribbon Stakes. Pretty impressive resume in 1998 for Fiji, and you can see why she was voted champion of that year. It was just ultra impressive. And again, looking back on Neil Drysdale's champions, AP Indy, Princess Rooney, Tasso, Hollywood Wildcat, and Fiji. And I thought the story that Neil told about Tasso was interesting. And again, as a person that doesn't like to look back on things in his career so much, well, that's what this show is all about. But he did a pretty decent job when I asked him that question about being so close with AP Indy, but not the first time he had been close to getting to the Kentucky Derby. Remember AP Indy? It was just hours before that they had to scratch AP Indy. Well, his juvenile champion, Tasso, never got the chance to go because as a three-year-old, before the Wood Memorial, he was spooked when a pipe, fell off a truck. He reared up, kicked himself in the leg. He ran in the wood, didn't run very well, and never made it to the Derby. That was Tasso. Then Neil comes back with AP Indy, and you know that after being so close to getting to the Derby twice, that had to play into the psyche of Neil Drysdale when he went there in 2000 with Fusaichi Pegasus. But as you heard him say, it didn't. He wasn't looking back. He was looking ahead. He lives in the present with his horses. And Fusaichi Pegasus took him to a whole nother level with that Kentucky Derby win. You know, everybody will tell me, a lot of trainers that I talk to, whether it be here on the show or I get a chance to visit with them privately, just like a jockey, the very first thing that people want to know when they find out you're a horse trainer or you're a jockey is what? Have you ever won the Kentucky Derby? That's the one question that everybody always gets. Well, for Neil Drysdale, that had to be somewhat of a painful question after the AP Indy thing, because he was there with a prime contender who then went on and took the Peter Pan and the Belmont after he had to scratch from the Derby. And Neil said, no, I never really thought about what might have been. Not my style. Never really thought about it. But boy, that would be awful tough not to think about. But Fusaichi Pegasus now allows Neil Drysdale to say yes to that question. To say, yes, I've won the Kentucky Derby. And boy, did he do it in a big way with a horse that was very hard to train, a bit of a handful, but Fupeg, as he became known, dominated the Kentucky Derby that year. Pretty impressive stuff from Neil Drysdale. And again, hope you enjoyed that as much as I do. You're going to be able to catch Trainer Talk on this very same SiriusXM channel each and every week now. This is our new home for Trainer Talk, for our Express Bet Weekend Stakes Preview on Fridays, and for tomorrow night's Brisnet.com call-in show. We'll be right here 6 to 7 Eastern every week with those three shows, Sirius 220, XM 206, and of course, always streaming worldwide on our website at horseracingradio.net and podcast on our site as well. A lot of people don't have the opportunity necessarily to listen live. They might be doing other things. Tons and tons of listeners have been going to our website to download those podcasts. So make sure you do the same. Go to horseracingradio.net. Listen at your leisure. You can also listen on your smartphone with our live streaming or with our podcast, and you can listen on iTunes as well, which is kind of a neat little feature there and another way to access the Horse Racing Radio Network. Well, when you talk about Neil Drysdale and you talk about six Breeders' Cup wins, it makes me think of what we might be in for this year. Not sure if Neil Drysdale will be at the Breeders' Cup with any of his prominent runners. He may, but we will be there. We'll be there with 20 hours, or nearly 20 hours, of Breeders' Cup coverage on site at Santa Anita. And our road continues this year with all the big races, the Charlestown Oaks coming up this Saturday evening, 9 to 11 Eastern time. Then we segue into all the great racing action on preview Saturday from Santa Anita with the awesome Again Stakes and the Zenyatta, all those huge races there at Santa Anita. We'll be on site there. We'll have another team for you with Anthony Stabile. He'll be on site at Belmont Park to bring you coverage of the Jockey Club Gold Cup and those big races there. So it's a huge, huge day, huge couple of weeks leading up to the Breeders' Cup, and then, of course, a gigantic week for us at the Breeders' Cup. Make sure you join us and make sure you follow us at Horse Racing Radio Network for that entire schedule. And of course, HRN on Twitter and Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook. Well, my thanks to Neil Drysdale. He was a joy to talk with here this evening. And again, I hope you enjoyed it. Looking forward to next week's Trainer Talk as well. Follow us on social media to learn Who's coming up next week, 6 to 7 Eastern, on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. A special thanks to Fasic Tipton and to all of our sponsors for supporting us here on the network. For my producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton.